Pledge allegiance to the
The
flag
flag of the United States
and to the republic for
public,
one nation under God, indivisible.
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The ballroom audio is muted.
Roger, at least I can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear each other.
Yeah, I think that microphone in the ballroom is muted. So we didn't realize that they were doing the pledge.
I sent a text to Christina to let her know.
Okay.
Okay, can you hear us now?
Yes.
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 Okay, shall we start over
Okay.
again? Roll call.
Roll call, Director Amezcua, Director Bilodeau, Director Green,
Yes.
Director Meeks,
Here.
Director Nguyen,
Here.
Director Sheldon,
Yeah, here.
Director Tran,
Here.
Director Wigand,
Here.
Director Whitaker,
Here.
Director Yeo.
Here.
Okay, you do have a quorum with eight directors present.
Okay, do we have any items received too late to be agendized?
There are none.
All right. Do we have any visitors who would like to speak? We'll listen. Nobody? Okay. Moving on to the consent calendar. We have a motion.
I'll make the motion. I'll second it.
Okay.
Roll call, Director Green.
Yes.
Director Meeks.
Yes.
Director Nguyen.
Yes.
Director Sheldon.
Yes.
Director Tran. Director Wigand.
Yes.
Director Whitaker.
Aye.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Director Bilodeau, did you want to vote on the consent calendar?
Yes.
Okay, that motion carries with yes, with nine yes votes, with Director Amezcua absent.
On our informational items, the future of Prado Wetlands Workshop.
Yeah, Madam President, I'll tee this up while Lisa gets up to the podium. But we've been operating wetlands for about 3 decades. And over that time, a lot has changed. The base flows coming down the Santa Ana River are about half of what they used to be. We no longer have over 300,000 dairy cows in the upper watershed and the pollution that came from that. And then the regulations for discharging water into the Santa Ana River have tightened up greatly. So we're kind of in a new era, and we wanted to just take a fresh look at the wetlands. And Executive Director Lisa Haney is going to present on the wetlands. And we thought tonight would be just informational, and that then we would come back a second time and even a third time if necessary to get direction from the board on what do we see for the wetlands going into the future. How should we operate them? Should we operate them? Just everything's on the table here. So with that, I'll introduce Lisa.
Okay.
Hi, good evening, President Green and board members. I'm excited to be here on behalf of our general manager and the other executive directors and staff who would like to talk about the future of the wetlands. I'd like to start with a definition of a wetland. A wetland is a place in which the land is covered by water, salt, fresh, or somewhere in between, either seasonally or permanently. So out at Prado Wetlands, we have the largest natural riparian wetlands, as well as the largest constructed wetlands, and so in Southern California. So that's significant. And it's important to realize that we have both kinds of wetlands in that area. As you all know, we do water conservation behind Prado. And because we hold water behind the dam, that creates a natural wetland. And so we have this area of natural wetlands, but we also have an area of constructed wetlands. And tonight, the conversation is to focus on the constructed managed wetlands and what the future of that should be. Okay, so this is a workshop. It's meant to be interactive. We'd like to present what we have learned to date, that we need to kind of look up and see where we're at and see if we need to be managing that constructed wetlands the same way or if we would like to do something different. And we would like to get your input. And we have already gotten input from stakeholders in the area, both internally and externally. And we'd like to share that with you tonight. We'd like to talk about operational costs. We'd like to talk about savings. We'd like to talk about impacts to others. We have neighbors who do rely on our wetlands. So we need to understand the impacts. And then we'd like to hear from you and know what your ideas are. So the objective tonight is to really just kind of take another look at what we're doing. And if it makes sense, this is our time to reimagine, and realign what we want it, the constructed wetlands to be and what purpose it should have. And if you haven't been behind Prado, one of our natural resources staff, Cameron, used a drone to take a video of the constructed wetlands portion so you could see what we're talking about. And just to orient you with where we are in this video, we're going to start at the diversion channel where the offices are, and then we're going to pan towards the dam, just so that you understand where we're going. Okay, so here we go. So this is the constructed part. You can see that there's lots of different cells within the wetlands. Those are managed by operations. It takes a lot of work and a lot of heavy machinery to get out there and maintain all of these cells. The constructed wetlands is 450 acres, roughly. And so that's a lot of territory to manage and operate. So let's talk about the history of the wetlands. All right, we know that the natural environment was already there. We did purchase the property back in 1968. In the early 1970s, the Rahogs came in and they built the constructed wetlands, and they built it for the purpose of duck hunting. And it remained that way for a long time. And then over time, about the 1990s, we realized there was a nitrate water quality problem regionally in that area. And there was an opportunity to do dual purpose with the constructed wetlands. It could still be used for duck hunting, but it could also be managed as a nitrate removal treated wetlands environment. And so we hired a wetlands manager whose responsibility was to design these wetlands for maximum nitrate removal. And that's how it operated for a very long time and was very successful in removing nitrate. Okay, so here's a map of the constructed wetlands area that has been managed over the years for nitrate removal. And I want to talk about where were the sources of nitrate? Why did we have nitrate? Well, back in the day, there were nothing but dairies out there, and the dairy waste contributed greatly to nitrates in the water. But it wasn't just the dairies. We also had wastewater flows from the upper watershed, which were mostly treated wastewater, which were high in nitrates. In addition to that, I'm going to point out this white arrow. Can you guys see that right here? That's a wastewater treatment plant. So we also have a direct discharge into the diversion channel into the wetlands. Okay, so just locally, that's a lot of nitrate. But that's not the only sources of nitrate in the region. There were a lot of other sources as well. And what you'll notice, I just want to point out on this pie graph, is that you had a majority where the base flows were high in nitrate. But the other source is the dark blue piece of the pie, which represents rainwater that fell in the mountains and then percolated into the ground and then came into Prado Basin. So you had two very high sources of nitrate to treat for. And what you'll notice over time is that you had base flows and wastewater treatment discharges. And you'll notice that that rose, from 1970 to 2000 because population increased and you had more wastewater treatment flows coming down the river. Now, somewhere around 2005, that's when we had water conservation start and we had droughts. And so you could see that that started to decline because people were conserving water. And then that trend has started to level out, which we've also noticed. So one of the things we wanted to ask ourselves when we're trying to imagine what to do with these treatment wetlands is, do we still need them to treat nitrate? Is that still a problem? And if we reduced the wetlands in any capacity, what effect would that have on the nitrate treatment? So the water quality group wanted to look at several different scenarios. One is the base flows declining over time. Right now, it's around 75,000 acre feet. We expect that to go down in the future. So we need to be thinking long term, not just right now. If those were to go down, how would that affect, what we do? Now, if we reduce the footprint of the constructed wetlands in combination with decreased flows, how does that affect nitrates? We have lots of different options. We can keep it as it is, or we can reduce the wetlands over time by certain percentages. So Claire ran all of the different models that related to this. And oh, I think I skipped one. I'm missing it. So this is just to represent the full constructed wetlands. And then if we were to reduce the scenarios, this is where we're at now. That white part that disappeared, we've already let that go. I mentioned we had a wetlands manager for a long time. At a certain point, maybe a decade ago, we released that position and we no longer manage this for nitrates at the same level. And because we didn't manage the wetlands, that white portion went back to a more natural, unmanaged part. So this is more representative currently of what we're managing. Yeah. So here's the part with the white, right? And this is the full constructed wetlands at its, the height of its time. Okay, and over time, we've realized we don't need to be putting so much effort into managing the wetlands to the point that we released a position and then we don't maintain it as much. And this white area is also inundated much longer than all the other cells because we're now holding water for water conservation. So it doesn't make sense to keep digging them out and cleaning them up because they're just going to be flooded anyway. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is really where we're at in terms of actively managing the constructed wetlands today. And then what we want to talk about is, do we want to reduce that footprint in the future? Do we want to go to 50% of what it used to be? Or do we want to reduce it to 70%? Or maybe we want to get rid of all of the constructed wetlands and let it go back to a natural riparian habitat. These are all different options on the table. Okay, here's the graph I was looking for. No matter what we do, whether we keep it or we get rid of it all, what the model shows is that nitrates are going to reduce over time. Doesn't even matter what we do, which means we have full options available to us to do whatever we want in this area. Nitrates are no longer going to be a concern over time. And that's because the dairies aren't there anymore. Wastewater treatment has improved. The flows have reduced, right? And then the wastewater treatment plant is doing a lot more recycling and also better treatment. So nitrates just aren't as a concern today as they used to be. So although the original purpose was duck hunting, recreational, and nitrate removal, I think we need to come up with a new purpose. And when we apply for permits to operate the wetlands, we get to dictate what we want to do. The permits that we apply for are project specific. So we are asking the environmental regulatory agencies to operate in a specific manner. Well, our permits are up for renewal. So this is the perfect time to reimagine and decide what we want to ask for the next 10 to 12 years going forward. And so we need to decide, do we want to reduce? Do we want to keep going? And we can put everything in there that we're doing now. We can stop. Just because we have a permit to operate it doesn't mean we have to operate it. Okay. Just gives us the choice to. And then we do need permits from lots of different entities. So we need the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Permit. We need the California Fish and Wildlife Permit. And then we need permission from Army Corps of Engineers. And so those are the permits that we operate today. And again, in those permits, we ask for permission to do activities there. So this is by our choice and by our design. We get to choose. Another reason we want to rethink these constructed wetlands is because, you know, the planning department And John is thinking about doing higher levels of water conservation at higher elevations. So this orange color that you see right now is representing 505 year round, which is what we're doing. So you can see that's already covering a majority of the constructed wetlands. The yellow that you see is the 508 deviation. And then the green would be the 512, which we hope for with a water control manual update. So this is, you know, what we're trying for in the near term. And what you'll notice is that pretty much covers 70% of the constructed wetlands. And that means it's going to be inundated with water for 4 to 6 months a year, depending on the weather. If it's a wet year, it will be inundated. If it's a dry year, then it won't be. But, you know, we can't predict, and, you know, the weather's the weather. But we need to be thinking about how do we want to manage this for either condition. So when we start thinking about a strategic vision or a plan for the wetlands, we need to think, you know, what are we using it for now? And do we want to use it in the same way going forward? So water quality needs. We already know we don't really have water quality needs anymore. The nitrates aren't a problem. Hunting and lease contracts. We have leasees out there for duck hunting. Now, they built the original wetlands for duck hunting, but they can still duck hunt in a natural riparian wetland as well. So, I mean, they duck hunt now on the ponds that aren't being maintained. So they can still do that activity, but it just won't be, you know, looking the same way over time if we choose to let it go back to natural habitat. So, but that would be a conversation, right, with our lessees if we were to change the wetlands. There are sensitive species that live in this area. You guys all know about the Leispel's vireo. So one thing to note is Leispel's vireo don't live in constructed wetlands. So they're not in this area at all. They live in the natural riparian wetland portion of the Prado Basin. So if we were to let this go back to a natural riparian habitat, we're creating more habitat for the Leispel's vireo. So in terms of, are we going to have regulatory entities upset with us? Probably not, because we're going to be creating habitat for an endangered species if we let it go back. There are other species of interest, but we are not required to mitigate or provide habitat for them. But they do exist there. We could also use that 450 acres and turn it into a potential moneymaker and develop a mitigation bank, you know, where we're selling credits to people who need it. That's a difficult process, and it usually takes 10 years to do. So that would be, you know, something we would have to plan for over time. But it's something to consider and put on the table. And then Prado Basin, the wetlands of the area that's not going to be inundated, that's above 512, that area has historically for decades been used for top-level research. School of Mines and UCI and Riverside. So much good research has come from that portion of the wetlands. And, you know, we think it would be good to keep continuing to have those kinds of relationships and opportunities. But we leave that to the board to decide and let us know what they think should happen with that area. And then, of course, that same area above 512 that we use for research, we also use for outreach and education. When we do our adventure outreach tours every year, that's where we take people. It's to show them the Prado wetlands, our water conservation, what we're doing out there. School groups go out there. We have the Salton Sea General Manager and Board of Directors coming out tomorrow just to look at our wetlands and how we operate it and manage it. So people are very interested in it. And the fact that it's the largest wetlands in Southern California, you know, we stand out. So a couple questions I kind of want to pose to you guys and to all of us is, you know, do the wetlands serve a purpose right now? Do we need to give it a purpose? Do they need to be operated the same way, or do we want to operate them differently? How do we strategically want to design these going forward, knowing what we know about water conservation and what we want to do in the future of holding water to higher elevations? Do we still want to do research? Do we still want, you know, outdoor education opportunities, public information opportunities? So right now, let's talk about the hunting operations and activities that exist. October to February is hunting season in the wetlands. So that's the time period. Our operations staff do help the Rohogs rebuild the cells for hunting. We have that partnership and agreement. We are still using the wetlands for nitrate management, even though it's not necessarily needed. It's still functioning and we're still operating it that way. And operations spends a lot of time out after storms, because the storms really do wash things out, and we have to rebuild these cells and also rebuild the roads. Now, we're always going to need to rebuild roads in the natural riparian habitat because we have regulatory requirements for monitoring that are associated with our biological opinion. And those permits are for the natural areas where Leispel's vireo live. And those are different permits, completely different permits and regulatory requirements than what we have for the constructed wetlands. Two separate regulatory requirements. We're never going to be able to walk away from our regulatory requirements for the natural environment because we're doing water conservation. But we can walk away from the constructed wetlands. There's no obligations. That's us asking to operate. Okay, if we were to let the constructed wetlands go back to natural, it would reduce some operations costs. You wouldn't have as many staff out there constantly rebuilding the cells. And so we've asked Ben and Mayhol to come up with cost estimate savings on an annual basis if we were to let it just completely go back to natural. And they estimate, roughly 100K savings a year. And we also asked Jason and the water quality group, because they do sampling out there, how much would it save the district if they didn't do the sampling? And for them, it was just 20K. So it's not a ton of savings, but it is some savings. And 10 years ago, we also lost the wetlands manager because we stopped managing it for nitrate. So you have that cost savings as well. You're not paying salary and benefits for a person to manage it. Okay, we do have the duck lease contracts, so we do make money off of the constructed wetlands, and that's important to consider as well. It's roughly the same amount as the operations cost, so kind of funny. I don't think we would lose this because they can still hunt even in the natural riparian. So I think we could still maintain this. But again, it's a conversation with our lessees.
Wetland?
Ducks prefer open water and they like to land in open water. So I think they would have better duck hunting if there were open ponds available to attract the waterfowl. But I know that they are actively hunting in the areas that are overgrown as well. But I think having a mix does work.
I was just curious.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's a great question. Okay, so this is the Prado Basin, and I just want you to understand that there are other lessees in the area, right? We have our lessee, but there are other lessees that are renting land and doing duck hunting with Army Corps of Engineers. And so they really depend on the water, the diversion water that we put through our wetlands. It then goes to them, and they're at the end of that. So if we're reimagining the wetlands, we also have to reimagine how we're going to bring water into the basin, and are we going to continue to ensure that the water makes it as far down south to the other lessees that aren't ours, but are the Army Corps? We do not have an obligation to do that. I think in the past there was a farmer who I think sued the agency because of impacts to their livelihood. And so I just bring that up as a consideration. It could be an impact to someone else's business. Now we can still operate it and divert water and make sure that they get water, but we are not currently obligated to do so. Okay, as I mentioned before, there are sensitive species besides the least Bell's vireo. Those are the only ones we're required to monitor for. But there's turtles and snakes and other birds that live in the constructed wetlands. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife always appreciates it when we do a little bit more. They would like for us to look out for these species. They would not require us to. And we have already talked to them as one of the stakeholders and asked them, would they have any problem with us converting this back to a natural habitat? And they said no. It was totally up to us what we wanted to do with this area. Okay, so again, we're not required to do anything with other species. And if we brought in more natural habitat, that just increases carrying capacity for the least Bell's vireo. Okay, we also do a lot of education and research, as I mentioned previously. And we do this in the green area at the upper part above 512. So we have school groups that go out there once a month usually. Plus we have other professional tours that like to go out and see what we're doing. It's also a great opportunity for us to talk about our wa water conservation efforts. I think when people can see the dam and where we hold the water and, how that water gets to our infiltration basins, it makes for a good public outreach story. And we do a lot of social media, talking about our water conservation efforts. So currently, we have very little facilities for education out there. We have very little area of shade to house people. We don't have a classroom. Tomorrow it's going to be a very tight squeeze to get the Salton Sea Board of Directors and General Manager. They're going to just have to stand in the hallways while we talk to them because it's too hot outside for them to stand outside and have us talk to them outside. Yeah, so be used to it. I understand. But we invite other people out there as well who maybe aren't as acclimatized to the hot weather. And it might be nice to have facilities that better accommodate it, children and regular people. Anyway, it is an opportunity when we're imagining the wetlands, what our social message is, and how we're helping people connect to the source water that they're ultimately drinking, right? So it's an opportunity for us. And of course, the research. School of Mines has recently approached us wanting to look at PFAS biomass in the area to see if they can sequester PFAS from the base flows. They spent a couple decades looking at emerging contaminants of concern and being able to sequester those into the biomass. So, there's still interesting research to be done. We're also doing our own research. Cheryl is leading a group of UCI students to look at inundation effects to mule fat, which is the species that the vireo live on. And we're going to do it's like a toxicity study. How many days of inundation does it take to kill a mule fat plant? Sometimes they just recover. Right now, we're doing mitigation based on an assumption that we're killing plants, but we don't know that. And the study that Cheryl's leading is going to have some scientific evidence to be and quantify whether or not that's a real assumption or not. So I think that'll be great. So we have several schools, Colorado Schools of Mines, Berkeley, Riverside, Irvine. Decades worth of research. It's very valuable space. People really appreciate it. And I mentioned our education and outreach. We'd love to put some more signs out there, really have it be a showcase place. Just ideas for your consideration. Okay, so I mentioned before, this is our current state of affairs. This is what we're currently managing right now. And so we'd like to talk about some different scenarios. So scenario A is we go to 50% reduction. I mean, we could do nothing and just keep doing what we're doing, right? But we could reduce to 50% and just really be managing that blue area, leaving open water for duck hunting and still doing nitrate. And then that green area focusing on education and outreach and research. We could reduce it all the way to 70%, which, if we're having a wet year, the inundation level is really going to be towards this level on wet years, right? And then we're just managing the green area. And maybe we just do education, outreach, and research, and maybe that's our focus, and let everything else go to natural. Or, we get rid of it all and we don't manage anything. We just go back to natural. So we'd like to kind of come back to this, where we're at right now and get your ideas and go back to these questions we asked at the beginning. What purpose do we want to have with these wetlands? How do we want to operate them? And to what level do we want to operate them?
Yes, thanks. You've been very detailed on this, but I just want to ascertain something as a general truth on this. It would seem to me that managed wetlands, it implies that we would have more responsibility and more liability.
But in many cases, you've explained that we're not really held to that so much. Going natural riparian would seem to alleviate us of a lot of liability or requirements management-wise. Is that generally true? Because that would, to me, that would be maybe something that would tilt it certainly in favor of surrendering this.
I think it is an operations question. And, you know, Mayhol and Ben have asked me to try to represent them as best as possible. But it would alleviate the operations burden for them in terms of maintaining all of those.
And if it's natural, we couldn't be held accountable for some new occurrence because it wasn't through our management or, you know, allowing something to happen. It would just happen on the natural. Would that be true, Jeremy?
What do you think would happen?
Maybe Lisa can take a first crack at it, and then I'll log
in. Yeah, I'm not sure what would happen or what the liability risk would be.
Some new elements being introduced that wouldn't have been our doing or mishandling or something like that.
So one of the things that with treatment wetlands, especially if you're doing like a mitigation bank, if you're doing it because there's a regulatory requirement to do it, and then you don't do it, well, you potentially violate if you're doing it because of CEQA, because you had committed to do that. Oftentimes, that's why people do treatment wetlands. But it sounds like that's not the case here. In the past, there was a regulatory driver. That regulatory driver was water quality and nitrate removal. That's no longer the case. And so then if you go back to a, you know, some of the regulatory risk associated with operating would be less because you've already hit the target. But if you commit to do that with regulatory agencies and then you fail to do it, that's where liability can arise.
But we would have no liability because we're not required to do this. We are not required to maintain these constructed wetlands in any way. We're asking to do that.
Yeah, I'll just add, I think under the way we're operating right now with a managed wetlands, I don't believe there's much liability for a managed wetlands versus just letting it go wild. I don't think that's a very big consideration.
Right. That's why I was trying to get more clarification. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
And so we did this to mitigate against the nitrates for ourselves or for others?
For both. We wanted to control the amount of nitrates going into our groundwater basin. Right. So we want it to control our own water quality, but there are basin limits as well for the region. And so we need it to meet that. And so we were using this constructed wetlands helped everyone in the area meet the nitrate water quality requirement.
But we didn't have to do that part of it. We just had to.
No, we did. We were part of a regional team, regional water quality basin team where we agreed to come together. To help manage the water quality, but we've
SAPA?
Yes, it is. And we were so successful with the treatment and then the reduction of, you know, the dairies and everything that it just has not been a problem over time. And so it's no longer a regulatory barrier to us or others.
Beyond nitrates, is there anything else upstream that would be protected or cleaned out through these managed wetlands that if we kept some of them, that would be beneficial? Is there anything else besides nitrates?
Well, there's PFAS in the river.
Right.
And so the research, you know, looking at biomass and sequestering PFAS, you know, I don't know what we'd do with the biomass once they were sequestered. You know, I've been talking to Jeremy about that, and I don't think we have a conclusion or an answer to that. But it would be interesting research, and then we could decide if we wanted to manage the rest of the wetlands for that purpose, right? We could put biomass in the larger areas and do more PFAS treatment. But we don't even know if it works yet. It's still in just the research stage.
Would it benefit us from doing a percentage and not all of it? You kind of dug really deep into the weeds here. We're kind of getting a 10,000 foot level. So I think we'd probably trust, you know, you and the staff that's researched this more than us. But do you think kind of a phased approach would be a better than just completely taking the whole bandage off and going that?
I always think a phased approach is a nice approach because change is hard for people in general. And you have a lot of stakeholders in that area. And abrupt change is hard. I think if you did a soft transition over time, it would be much easier for everyone to kind of take. And then we could also monitor water quality as we go.
And do you think that would be the phased approach would start at 50% or even as high as that 70% removal?
I think that's kind of the question we're posing to you guys. I think it doesn't matter to us and we don't see a benefit either way. It's I think operations would prefer the 70%. but again, I don't have a recommendation, actually. It can be whatever we want it to be. I think a phased approach starting at 50 is wise, and then we could change it over time to 70.
And the stakeholders that you had mentioned, have we communicated any of this to them, or is this kind of the initial step?
So we did reach out to them to just understand what their needs were, but we did not suggest anything because we don't want to scare anyone, and we don't have a plan.
Did they seem fearful or worrisome about any type of removal?
I would say the only concerns were the duck leases on the Army Corps property and then just making sure that they still get water directed towards them so that we keep the diversion channel going and that we direct it, you know, in that direction rather than just letting it naturally go wherever it wanted. So I think there was some, you know, there's some concern there.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Director Meeks?
Yeah.
Director Meeks?
Yes, thanks. You know, I would support a phased approach. And I think not only does it help us kind of identify any negative impacts that maybe we haven't found yet, but it also, as it goes back to natural, it helps the animals out there kind of adjust and figure out, you know, where their next nesting area is and things like that. If they've used this maintained area for a long time, for the years that it's been there. So I would support a phased approach, but I would also support keeping the education and research piece. I mean, as you noted, that's been a very valuable for a lot of the universities, for our education, for educating people on what we do. But I also think that it's important to have those kind of facilities and functions because we don't know what the next challenge in water quality and our business is going to be. And so to be able to have that kind of use out there, to be able to have that information, to be able to work with the universities and solve future problems that we might not even know about yet. I think it's important to maintain an area on that. I don't know how staff feels about that, but just kind of looking long-term, it seems to me we want to be able to participate in research. So those are my thoughts.
Staff would definitely support that as well as our public information office who like to utilize that area.
How do you feel about that? Mail.
Yeah.
Actually, operational context for the whole thing, this kind of where it came up is we have a very short window each year where the heavy equipment guys and our other operators can get in and groom the pond, so to speak. So they get overgrown, right, over time, especially if we get a lot of precipitation. We have a short window between nesting season and upcoming duck hunting season to get in and strategically try to groom the ponds and get them ready for duck hunting season and to keep them so the water's flowing through them so they're not inundated riparian habitat. That window gets really small, especially in a heavy rain year like the last 2 years, because we have all of our forces cleaning basins and getting the river ready for the upcoming storm season. So that small window, we end up sending almost all of our forces out there to groom these ponds, get them ready, and then set aside the rest of the summer to hopefully get to the rest of the recharge system. And there are areas right now, like Lisa was mentioning, especially towards what we call the East Ponds and the South Ponds, that stay inundated almost all the time now that we're at the 505 conservation level that we just can't even get to. And when they do end up being dry in certain years, we do go in there and try to maintain them. But over time, as they get more and more overgrown, it takes longer to maintain them. And so then we also bring in some outside forces to help us with that. So the window gets shrunk every year, and we just got to decide, is our time and our forces best sent keeping the same amount of constructed wetlands or reducing them and having our forces be more available to our bread and butter, so to speak, which is getting as much water in the ground as we can through the rest of the recharge system. Now, granted, the duck hunting is a valuable, you know, recreational output, and there's always going to be, in my mind, if we go with one of the phased approaches, that can help alleviate some of that concern. And then we do spend a lot of time keeping the diversion up. So I think that's something that even in a phased approach, we'd have to continue to do that. Those of you who've been out to the wetlands at River Road, we have to, you know, build a sand diversion, keep it up. That's what diverts half the flow over from the main river into the constructed wetland system. It washes out all the time. It has other issues, so we maintain it. So we spend a lot of time making sure that stays in place. In a phased approach, you would still want to do that, but that's another part of that same minimal time frame we have to be out there between seasons to make sure that that stays in place as well. So this is all kind of envisioning, if we're not using the wetlands for some kind of water quality benefit to the regional plan of the basin, is a phased approach or a partial reduction something we want to consider so we can use our forces for other things, while at the same time, can we still keep enough recreational benefit that we're not affecting some of our current lessees and then our downstream lessees that are not on our property? And that really, like Lisa said, has to do with being able to still divert water, which would be maintaining what we call the 50-50, the diversion berm at River Road.
Director Sheldon has his hand raised.
Director Sheldon.
Thank you, Madam President. I'd like to say this is a great idea. And I'm very pleasantly surprised that we have this comprehensive proposal in front of us. We would not have maybe had this a few years ago. And I think we should keep everything on the table and not dismiss anything. And certainly not, of course, I can't embrace anything yet till we have more information. But our mission is water supply. We manage and protect the groundwater. Water conservation is an element of that for us. And if that's not as necessary or necessary, then we're not fulfilling the water supply mission out there. That's got to be the main mission. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes, when you talked about biomass to be able to sequester PFAS, that would certainly be promising. Supercritical water oxidation would be an option on that. The only problem is the distance to transport that. So I don't know if that proves to be successful at OC San, whether or not an upstream sanitation department could utilize that type technology. So the transfer wouldn't be very, very difficult.
Great idea.
Yeah, it's definitely something to keep in mind. And if supercritical oxidation does work out, potentially you could have a facility up there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They are having issues, though, at the moment, making it work and meeting AQMD standards.
It's AQMD is the problem. Thanks.
Well, do you have any guidance for us before we come back to you a second time so that we can direct our attention appropriately? What would you like, if we were to come back, what would you like to see?
Well, we could come back in October, maybe early November, and have some actual options that the board could vote on. Tonight, though, was just informational and getting feedback. And if you think of anything else in the next few weeks, give staff that feedback. But maybe, a meeting in October or early November, we could come back with actual options and the board could say and vote on options to partially keep it open or 100% close it, or and then we'll have what we need.
we're leaning towards?
I don't know. I don't know if we have a clear vision yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a hard subject, and we sprung it on you tonight. So you'll have time to think about it the next few weeks. And then when we come back, you know, maybe board members will have a clear vision on what they want, and we can vote. And if we need a third meeting, we can do that also. There's no rush here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Director White.
Would the stakeholders be able to be kind of updated a little further then, so that, you know, if we did go with a higher number than 50 or 70, even the whole thing, you know, we would have had that discussion with them so that they're kind of aware that we're having that. Do you think that's wise before we come back to us, or should we vote then send it to them?
So we've talked to all the regulatory stakeholders.
We have.
We have not talked to the duck lease people, correct?
That's correct.
So we do need to go out and let the leasees for the duck hunting know what we're thinking. And we would do that in September. And but as Mayhold mentioned, even if we were to abandon the wetlands, we could still divert water from the river over toward where the duck hunting goes. And they would have a source of water. Now, that may not be exactly what the duck hunting people want, but maybe that would be a compromise. And frankly, we don't want the duck hunters to drive what we're doing.
Right.
It's kind of a secondary issue what the duck hunters want. Yeah. But it would be nice to know if they would be fine with the idea, or maybe they have other options themselves. So that's something we need to do. And we would bring back that information to the board at our second meeting. So that we're fully aware of the impacts to the duck hunters.
So you would be asking them whether they would be all right with just repairing, or do they actually need the repairing?
And they prefer wide open ponds.
Sure.
Yes. But if we gave them something kind of close to that, and again, whatever we decide, it could be almost an experiment. We could decide, okay, let's get rid of half and see how things work. And then we could, in a few years, regroup and then go from there. And so whatever we decide is, you know, it's not irreversible. We could try different ways of operating. But yeah, we should probably phase it in as we've talked. Yeah.
You have any other you'd like to address the board on? Okay.
Thank you for your feedback.
Okay. Wow. Thank you for that report. Okay. SAPA?
Yes. Yesterday morning's SAPA commission meeting, we had almost a retread of two prior items. They're both informational, and the names are extremely long, so I'll spare you on that. Details are in the packet.
Okay, thank you. All right, moving to committee conference meeting reports. Property, Director Sheldon.
I'm sure. I was in attendance at the property meeting, and we did take one significant action tonight, which was on the consent calendar, which is to terminate our pursuit of the decertification process at Burris Basin for a variety of reasons. And that was really the big action that we took.
Okay. Moving on to retirement.
Yeah, I can cover that too. As Director Bilodeau had mentioned in his report, very similar. We did have one major item related to stable value fund options, which we made some good decisions and we'll be coming back to have our full recommendations later. But that was also something we voted on the consent calendar this evening, and the information is also in the back.
Okay. Moving on to verbal reports, I'll skip a president's report. General Manager?
I just wanted to mention one thing. We've been working with Assembly Member Cody Petrie Norris's office for a potential GWRS tour on October 2nd. To potentially the lieutenant governor, potentially Senator Padilla, and then potentially lots of other local representatives. We're not sure if it's going to happen or not, but if it does happen, it would be something, say, like 10 in the morning through lunch. So just something to be aware of. We'll see if we can get all these people down here for a tour.
We have any director's reports?
I do a different style here, but in my alma mater of Newport Harbor High School, I get to be a mentor, and my mentee has chosen to come to our meeting tonight. His name is Cooper Holland, and he had an option of going to either shadow me at a city council meeting or a water board meeting, and he chose this. So I applaud him, and so you get it. So if you get an opportunity on the way out and just introduce yourself, that would be nice for him to get an understanding of what all you guys do. So thank you.
Okay. General Counsel?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. No closed session tonight. I'll just a couple of quick previews of things to come. The legislature passed unanimously SB 1243, which amends the Levine Act in some ways that some of you will probably like. But the governor hasn't signed it yet, so I have a memo that we've prepared, and as soon as he inks it, I'll get it out to you folks. It should make less difficult to comply with. So that's one issue. And then also...
Was it urgency, or was it something that won't come into play until January?
That I don't signed? Know. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's urgency or not. So it could be January. I'll let you know in the memo. And then the other issue is the HCD issued their Surplus Lands Act guidelines about a month ago, and we'll be providing an update to the board at the Property Management Committee meeting, so you'll have that to look forward to.
Did that change appreciably?
It changed, but in ways that I think are actually helpful, and that's not always the case. In this case, I think it did more predictability, which is generally a good thing. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. We are adjourned.